Thanks for coming back to another episode of Pitch It, a fintech conversation amongst founders, investors, and friends. I'm your host, Todd Anderson, Chief Content Officer at Fintech Nexus. And what we do is we take a peek behind the curtain. What motivates someone to start a company? How do investors make the right bet? What do accelerators do during and help enabling the process of growing your company? How do banks think of founders? Not to mention, we try to have some fun, and what you'll see is we'll also do some special episodes. We have some new features coming, so stick with us, and you'll get all you'll need to know about the fintech startup landscape. Pitch It is really a part of a larger podcast network here at Fintech Nexus. You can go to my colleague Peter, our co-founder and chairman, for Fintech One-on-One. You can subscribe to his feed, or we have our newest podcast by one of our writers, Isabel Castro, the Fintech Coffee Break. For everything produced by Fintech Nexus, you can check out Fintech Nexus Podcast, which is really our content fire hose. All shows, webinar replays, even in-person event content, not to mention our weekly news show. As always, we hope that you rate the show and write a review. I try to really take listener feedback seriously, and as it helps make the show better. You can also follow the podcast and all of our podcasts on the feed of your choice, whether it be Apple, Spotify, wherever you like to listen, or come directly to news.fintechnexus.com. Now, let's get on with the show. On today's episode, I'm joined by Ron Benegbi, founder and CEO of Uplink. Ron and I discuss his history of entrepreneurship. He started, I believe it's between 4 and 5 companies, and how that ties closely to him and his family's journey as immigrants to Canada. We also talk about the SMB credit score, or lack thereof, and why that is. The shifting definition of small business, depending on the market or country you might be in, the overuse of the term as a service, getting more lenders to yes through the Uplink platform, fraud detection as a byproduct, raising capital, the NFL draft, and much, much more. A couple of short PSAs. We're just a month away from the USA event, so these will be ending soon. But we are still accepting applications to Pitch It at Fintech Nexus. Please head to fintechnexus.com for details. You can just go to the startups page. The specific link will be in the show notes. And if you want to sponsor an episode, come on as a guest, or sponsor one of our many digital or in-person offerings. Not much time left to sponsor the USA event. You can obviously still buy tickets. Speaking is essentially full at this stage. But just go ahead and reach out. Todd, T-O-D-D, at fintechnexus.com. Now, without further ado, I present Ron Benegbi, founder and CEO of Uplink. Enjoy the episode.
Hey, Ron, welcome to the podcast. How are you?
Good, Todd. Thanks for having me. Excited to be here.
Of course. Well, I appreciate your time. And, if we can kick off with, tell us a little bit about yourself, kind of what's your professional journey been? Tell the audience a little bit about you.
Yeah. So Ron Benegbi, serial entrepreneur. Uplink, which I'm currently involved with now, is my fifth. And as I've been told, Todd, it's my last startup. By the way, that's a true story. I've had a couple of good runs, good exits, and I've also had a horrific flop. So by no means have I batted 1,000. Mm-hmm. And really, I would tell you right now, I'm working on not just another startup. It's a bit of a passion project, because ultimately our goal or purpose as an organization is to extend working capital into the hands of small businesses around the world, mm-hmm, through our tech and how we work with our customers. So excited to be able to share that story and that vision and that passion, and hopefully be able to transform small business lending as we know it today.
So you know, before we get into exactly what you guys are doing, how you're doing it, you know, clearly you have a passion for entrepreneurship. You know, where does that come from? Is it, you know, your mom and dad were entrepreneurs? It's just kind of ingrained from a family. As someone who started so many businesses, it's probably come from somewhere. So tell us a little bit more about that passion.
It's a great question. It's actually very relevant to Uplink. You know, I'm an entrepreneur, but first and foremost, I'm an immigrant. And my family migrated to Canada in the early 70s. We were poor. We had no money. My dad was baking bread at night to put food on the table. And he went to a bank in 1973. And I know I'm dating myself a little bit because I look really, really young. And I appreciate you thinking that, by the way. So he went to a bank in 73 and he asked them for a small business loan. To which the banker told him, you know, Mr. Benagby, you really don't qualify for how a bank lends to small business. Mm-hmm. However, I believe in people, and here's $5,000.
Wow.
And that took $5,000 in 1973. He started a small business. So, you know, entrepreneur, turned it into a medium-sized business. And my mom, a year later, got her real estate license, and in the winter of 1974, started knocking on people's doors. Now, today, she'd, you know, probably be arrested, but back in 1974, when you're knocking on someone's doors, it's like, oh, hi, how are you? Yeah. And she just, hey, do you want to sell your house? And she built a, you know, a nice small business professional services company in the real estate sector. So to answer your question, you know, my parents have been lifelong entrepreneurs. You know, they've been small business owners, which is very relevant to Uplink. And it's by virtue of the apple doesn't fall far from the tree, I would tell you that it's sort of been an embedded thought process in me as I've grown up, and it's really all I've known at the end of the day. So I hope that answered your question.
It most certainly did. So tell us, how did you get to the point of starting your current venture, Uplink? And ultimately, when answering that question, how'd you come up with the name?
Oh, well, the name, you know, candidly, wasn't anything magical. I don't remember this website, but we used one of those AI, you know, generating website names. Now, there was no ChatGPT. I bet you ChatGPT would have just crushed it. So unfortunately, there was no ChatGPT wasn't around at that time. But we used one of those, you know, AI name generation website. And what I like about them is you get to kind of put in some of the key ethos of the business and some of the things you're trying to focus on. And, you know, they spit out a bunch of names, most of which are not great, but some of which are actually quite interesting. And Uplink was one of them. And it's not like it had a personal meaning to me or a direct relation to the business, but I thought it was kind of catchy. I thought it was short, easy to pronounce, easy to understand. And out of that, you know, felt like we could build a brand around that. So candidly, that was the name. And in terms of your first question was like, how did we get into the business? I just want to make sure
How did you come to the idea of Uplink? Was it, you know, an issue that you saw in your previous venture and kind of you said, well, no one's solving this. Maybe I can solve this. Kind of how'd you come up with the concept and ultimately the idea for the company?
Yeah. So if you go back to this immigrant story, you know, as a small business owner, my parents got lucky. There was no way my dad qualified for a loan in 1973. And it's something that's always sort of motivated me. And as we've, you know, small business owners or small business within the context of financial services has always been an underserved category. No one would ever debate that. And what's happened with the pandemic and the devastation that it's had on the small business owner in the last few years, and now as we enter these uncertain economic times and conditions, access to fair and ethical credit has never been more difficult for a small business owner to attain. Yeah. So it really ties back to my roots. And in early 2021, I had a vision of trying to find a solution or deliver a solution to lenders who lend to small businesses that can help them look at data and evaluate risk and credit that goes beyond traditional sets of information. So give me 3 years financials and let me overlay a credit score for small business and I'll make a credit decision. Well, in today's world, with a ton of new businesses being out there, the DNA profile has changed. Do they even have 3 years financials? If they do, are they accurate? Credit scores have traditionally been proven not to work in small business, not talking consumer. You know, it's just gotten harder. So I wanted to develop, come up, or deliver a solution to the market that ultimately enabled lenders to say yes more often. And what that means is if they have a certain risk profile that they evaluate, and let's say they decline, I don't know, 90% of applicants, we could show them that within that 90%, and I'm making this up, you could have actually approved half of those within your existing credit framework. So not thinking differently about credit, but just showing you through empirical data and science that you really had a good customer in front of you that you said no to. And that ultimately is what inspired Uplink. It was a bit of a, you know, a different journey. It wasn't that simple, and we can get into it. I'm sure we will. But to answer your question, that was the thought process behind it.
So tell us more about exactly what you guys do and how you do it. And, you know, is there ultimately, is there an ideal small business that would fit for the types of data that you guys provide and the product that you provide? Is there kind of an ideal company, or does it range depending on the lender's parameters?
Oh, it definitely ranges depending on the lender's parameters, but our product is so, it has so much utility, both in terms of, you know, being able to be used for different lines of, you know, different credit lines, whether it be a line of credit, a credit card, secured, unsecured, et cetera. And our ability to help lenders lend as little as $1,000 or as much as $30 million and everything in between really creates a pretty broad spectrum of what our product can do and, you know, who lenders can lend to utilizing our product. In a nutshell, what we've done is a bit of an unusual story. We're not the typical fintech that, you know, went out, raised some money, spent 2 years in a basement, and now we've got the coolest product since sliced cheese. Not our story. I'm sure it's somebody else's story, and that's a great story. It's not ours. What we did was, and this was going back to the initial vision, and candidly, sometimes it's just better to be lucky than good. I had been introduced to my co-founder, who over a period of 15, 16 years had actually built out this legacy technology through different engagements with different FIs all over the world. What we did was we actually carved it out of his previous company, created a new shell company, Uplink, who then acquired the asset and now has brought it to market. And what that's done, Todd, is it's given us a very powerful narrative, because that previous technology over a long period of time had been tested in the market, had connectivity to over 10,000 different sources of data in 150 countries on small business, had delivered data sets that all met regulatory compliance tests and approvals in every local market, and had ultimately in the aggregate enabled lenders in those markets to generate over $1.4 trillion in lending volume. So we were able to take the insights out of that, all of the connectivity points out of that, and bring that to the market in this new modern day fintech called Uplink. And that's why I'll tell you, it's been a bit of a sort of an unusual story. We go when we start pitching a bank or a partner, and they go, we don't get it. How are you 2 years old and yet you have all this? It doesn't correlate. So we have to get into the details of the story. Once they hear the story and once they look under the hood, it's wow, this is a highly novel approach to SME credit scoring.
So tell us more about that approach. How does, ultimately the product help a lender? How are you able to, in that example that you gave, if they're declining 90%, I mean, how do you get them to the 50% you mentioned as kind of a ultimate more yeses? And I would think if they're getting to more yeses, these are better yeses as well with the data.
For sure. So, what our product ultimately does, it is an API just like every other, fintech startup out there, but it provides a very simple dashboard, call it set of data metrics to a lender. And what it does is it evaluates, let's look at a simple use case on a loan origination. So you're a small business owner, Todd. Let's just say you're applying to your bank for a $50,000 unsecured line of credit to help you sort of with day-to-day working capital.
Yeah.
What our technology does is it helps within the context of that evaluation process by tapping into the bank's own data sets, our own data sets, and it provides what we call two scores. They're not traditional credit scores like you would get out of an Experian or a Moody's or an Equifax. One is a probability of default. And the other is something that we call it's a confidence risk score, which is tied into a highly mathematical equation. Long story short, I'm not sure I can even explain it properly. It's highly accurate and predictive. And ultimately, we present those two scores in combination with the lender's existing scoring system, in combination with other scoring tools or services the lender may use. So we're not trying to sell a scoring platform. We're trying to provide as much information to the lender. Okay, here's how we would evaluate the risk on this applicant. Mm-hmm. Here's how you evaluate risk. Here's how Experian evaluates risk. Make your decision ultimately with what's comfortable for you. So it's really, in essence, it's almost like a benchmarking tool that we deliver our own sets of unique data points that the lender has ultimately felt is highly, highly predictive and highly accurate. And going back to your first question, it's, every lender has a different framework in terms of if and how they lend, and we don't try to change that. But ultimately, our technology is then attenuated to the lender's own risk criteria. And then the scores that come out will ultimately either fit or not fit within that criteria. And what we've seen is because of our access to all of this different information that we have. We have more access to information than pretty much any bureau on the planet. And Equifax, by the way, is a big partner of ours. Between all that information that we have access to, between the historical insights that we have access to, that 1.4 trillion, the amount of highly vetted and highly accurate data that we present to a lender is unmatched by anything out there. So they feel comfortable in considering our recommendation. And I want to make that clear. We're not a loan origination system. We're not a decisioning engine. We don't ask lenders to rip out credit scores or risk models that they've already built. We're a tool. that is an additive within their existing credit process.
Why is it that you've mentioned score a few times, and obviously we have the traditional credit score on the consumer side that's it has a number of problems with it, but ultimately it's a pretty good predictor of whether or not you'll pay back a loan, a credit card, or whatnot. But in the small business side, we've never gotten to that point. As someone who knows, this type of data as well as you do, why do you think that? And it sounds like you guys are giving at least a version of that with some of the stuff that you guys do. But, why do you think it's never really gotten to the point of like a credit score for consumers and a credit score for commercial companies?
It's a great question. And the best person in the world to answer it is my co-founder, but because he's not here, I will do my best to answer it. So a bit about my co-founder, he's like 35 years in the business. He big P&Ls that he ran. So he's a lender by trade, but he also ran product at Equifax for 2 years, was one of the original authors of the first Equifax small business credit scores. He knows what goes into a small business credit score better than anybody on the planet. So going back to your question, small business is a completely different animal than an individual consumer. An inherent problem. There are a number of inherent problems in small business credit scores today. The first being is they're built as a one size fits all. Yeah. So whether you're a restaurant owner in Manhattan, a wholesale plumbing shop in Kansas City, or you're in the agricultural business in Northern California, and you're in a rural environment, the model is the model. It doesn't differentiate. And therefore, a lot of these models work better in highly populated rural environments urban environments versus rural environments. Also, these models, they don't factor in things that you and I would think, who are not modelers, think of as common sense. So, you know that the FICO score doesn't take into account the type of loan product you're applying for. So again, Todd, you're that small business owner. Whether you're applying for a $10,000 credit card for your business or a $300,000 unsecured line of credit or a $1 million secured or collateralized loan of some kind, the score doesn't factor that into the calculation. Now, you and I just like, that's crazy. Like that is nuts. So when you talk about the inherent problems of these scores, you see a lot of that. A lot of these small business credit scores also, number of them are actually dependent on specific pieces of information as well. So if you don't have 3 years financials or don't have certain financials, they can't score or they can't score you properly. Well, that's a problem. A lot of businesses that started up in the pandemic don't have 3 years financials. So when you're looking at all of these factors, you can see inherently that, the way small business credit scoring is done versus that of consumer, which is a completely different game, it's completely different. And there are a number of challenges that are inherently creating these issues as to why small business owners who should be funded have trouble accessing fair funding.
So I see that when doing research, I went to your website, and there's a number of really quality bank brands on there, from Citi to Chase to Itaú in Latin America. How different or how complicated is it, in serving the different markets that you serve, the different countries that you serve, and what they might consider, or we might consider in the US, a small business versus you in Canada versus, a lender in Brazil. How complicated does that get for the data that you and the platform that you guys provide?
Yeah, I think there's a few questions in there. First of all, there's what you've touched on, the definition of what is small business.
Yeah.
You could go to two different US banks of roughly the same size, and they will give you two different definitions. and we come across that all the time. Whereas, somebody wants to use our technology in the context of wholesale small business lending, but lending up to like $8 million. Well, you could argue that an $8 million loan really borders on commercial. Yeah. And yes, there's absolutely that definition phase that we have to go through with every lender we serve in terms of what is your definition of small business without question? And how does our technology fit within that? Now, given that our technology is so flexible, and if you remember earlier, I said, it's helped lenders lend like $1,000 in Africa to up to $30 million, which is really not small business, it's commercial, and everything in between. We've got a lot of flexibility with how our technology happens to perform. But going back to your question related to geography, that obviously, the ability to extract information is, geography plays a key role in it. We obviously have a lot less ability or a lot less data, in Brazil, and Brazil is a big economy, than we do in the United States. We have a lot less data in Bangladesh than we would in, let's say, a market like the UK. Mm-hmm. The good news is we still have the ability to pull a lot of data, and the data that we pull, most of it is not traditional data. And they use the word alternative data. I think that word is a little buzzy, but I try to explain it as, we're pulling environmental data, we're pulling community data, we're pulling government data, we're pulling data that ultimately looks at the ecosystem or the world around the small business owner and what could impact the performance of, the local restaurant on Main Street and Fourth. In addition to traditional data sources like financials, bank statements, and of course, bureau scores. So geography does play a part in it. We are about to launch actually a fairly large lender in India. And India is a huge economy, but yes, it presents different challenges than, again, the United States or Canada, even in terms of accessing information.
I see that on the website you use the term credit assessment as a service. It feels like everything is as a service these days. I mean, as someone that has that on their website, I mean, do you think the term's overused, misunderstood? Any reasoning behind like using credit assessment as a service? Just kind of curious as to, what your thoughts were there, and if you think the term, the terminology is overused these days.
Yeah, it's probably overused way too much. Like, we tried not to get into buzzy words. And if you actually look at the rest of our website or even our sales materials, I don't think we use credit assessment as a service even once. So why did we use it there? Well, if you look at, that's the landing page, and that's the top of the landing page. So in 10 seconds, we're trying to get somebody to commit to staying on that page and on our website. And, you know, our product is a little bit more complex than here's an API, pull some data out of QuickBooks and away you go. So we've tried to really simplify it as much as we can. As far as assessment as a service, yeah, it's everybody uses that in some sort of context. At the end of the day, what we're trying to convey is we have a platform. It has a lot of information in it. It's been highly vetted. It's been used by some of the biggest. And by the way, Todd, some of the smallest banks in the world, smallest, like really small, have used this too. And I'm equally proud to say that. Mm-hmm. And you can feel confident as a lender to know that the product that we deliver to you ultimately has been highly tested and vetted, has met regulatory approval, and ultimately has been statistically validated to be accurate. So yeah, as far as the terminal, I actually looked at that a couple of weeks ago and I thought of taking credit assessment as a service off, but I just didn't get around to it. But yeah, is it an overused term? For sure it is.
You mentioned obviously through our conversation here about getting to more yeses for the lender. What about default rates and ultimately those yeses being higher quality yeses? You know, how does your platform, you know, say versus a traditional underwritten loan perform? And, you know, what do you say to in terms of, you know, how default rates are, you know, for the lenders that start using your platform? Do they see defaults drop 10, 20, 30%? You know, how are default rates as compared to maybe the other or more traditional way that the bank might lend?
Well, you know, it's interesting because whenever as a service provider, which we are to lenders all over the world, you know, you're always trying to listen to your potential customer and understand what their hot buttons are. And it's interesting, as we were building out or repurposing the tech and going in, I thought, you know, default rates would be a big, big hot button. And, you know, interestingly enough, it hasn't been a big hot button for most of the lenders we've talked to. And I'm talking some, every lend, like a lot of these names you would know, and some you wouldn't know as well. Not that it isn't important, but they all sort of seem to have a common thread. And that is, and especially now, and that is, help me increase my loan book and help me especially. You're telling me that people I've declined, I should have said yes to. That is very interesting for me. But to answer your question, you know, from you know, what kind of sort of statistical evidence do we have in terms of performance? You know, uplift, you can see anywhere between 5 to 15x in terms of loan approvals. And in terms of what we call credit quality, which is just a fancy schmancy way of lowering your default rates, the same thing. Mm-hmm. 3 to 7 times reduction or enhancement in credit quality. So there's definitely an improvement in seeing less defaults. Again, with defaults, it's a little trickier because every lender looks at defaults a little bit different.
Yeah,
they have their own definition of defaults and when they call something a default, when they don't. So it's a little bit trickier. And like I said, the big hot button that we've seen has been around, help me say yes more often. So I hope that answered your question.
Yeah, no, for sure. You know, fraud is clearly becoming a, if it wasn't before, it's obviously exploded, especially with the onset of the pandemic and, you know, the technology that fraudsters are using. Obviously, they're on the cutting edge as well. And I think what we've seen a lot in recent years is fraudsters are getting so emboldened by using even Twitter and other platforms that they just collaborate together. in such an open manner, which obviously the good guys, the banks and others can't do for a variety of reasons. I mean, I know they collaborate, but, you know, they can't openly say, hey, this this fraudster or this theme. But I would imagine with a platform like yours and the data that you provide, it does, a byproduct of that is helping with fraud, just because the more data points you have on a company, the easier it is to weed out, all right, this company is obviously not worthy, or there's something fishy going on here. Has that been a byproduct? Was it a focus going in? Is it just something you found out? Like, any focus on fraud going into the product, and has it been a byproduct of what you guys built?
I think byproduct is an excellent descriptor of how our technology would relate to fraud, without question. It hasn't been sort of the front and center conversation when we go into a bank or a big lender and say, hey, this is what our technology does. But certainly as a byproduct of what we're doing, here's what it does. And, you know, an interesting example, we got asked this question last week. We were at CBA Live, which is the Consumer Banking Association's yearly show in Las Vegas. There was a lot of bankers there. And, you know, we had a bunch of meetings like everyone does, and we got asked that question. And Pat, my co-founder, he actually gave a really interesting example where there are loan applicants, small business loan applicants, let's say, who say that they're in the manufacturing business and they're, you know, doing these kinds of volumes and stuff like that. Well, some of the data feeds we actually tap into are like satellite imagery, where we're tapping into it through various sources that can actually, through a heat map, actually detect activity levels during different windows of time. So if somebody's telling you they're running a manufacturing shop 24/7, yet you're only seeing it Monday to Friday, 9 to 5,
yeah,
you know, they're lying. you know, that's a red flag. So yeah. What I would tell you is, and maybe that's a little bit of an out of the box example, but to answer your question, it's definitely a byproduct. We're very clear that we are not a fraud prevention company. That's not our, there's a lot of those fintechs out there.
Oh yeah.
Some of them do a great job. Like, and you know, so I, what we say is, hey, if you're working with one of them, that's great. Between you, the value, the service you're getting from them and what we're bringing, it's just, again, an additive. It will only help. And I think byproduct was a great way to describe what we do in that area.
I'm sure you have a litany of lessons, especially from your various ventures, but specific to Uplink, you know, what's been one of the biggest lessons that you've learned since you launched the company a couple of years ago?
Yeah, I mean, they're you're right. I've got so many lessons. Like the biggest lesson I've learned probably took place in 2011. But you know, for me, it's what I saw was, you know, at times, you know, we got a little bit too excited in terms of going down a path without actually doing the right type of vetting from a customer validation point of view. Mm-hmm. So that inherently does a couple of things. A, you waste a lot of time. B, you spend money. And by the way, that's, you know, it's funny, you say, well, you're an experienced operator. You know, some of these trials and tribulations are, you go through them regardless of your age and how many times you've done this. It's just part of the game. So I would tell you, you know, in many ways, we've gone through some of the, you know, typical startup stuff, first time founder stuff, where, you know, maybe we jumped the gun a little bit early. We didn't have enough validation points. We tried to do too much too quickly. So from that perspective, I would tell you, certainly there have been some lessons learned. you know, I think a good quality of any sort of founder is the ability to evolve and pivot as needed and be able to overcome some of these obstacles that are always, they're always going to be there. So I hope that answered your question.
What about on the other side, which is, do you have a regret since starting Uplink that you can share?
You know, I actually don't. I don't have any regrets. I mean, I thought about it because I saw your questions earlier. And, you know, one thing came to mind when I saw that question, and it's really tied to my answer I just gave you. And it's, I'm a very conservative operator. And to me, I'll give you an example. Like, I will fight with the local food delivery company who didn't deliver an order to, let's say, my employees ordered lunch, and then I got charged like $17 for something. And this actually happened. And I will write letters to the CEO. I want my $17 back. This is theft. You're stealing from me, and you're stealing from my invest. Like, this is theft. So going back to your question, I thought about, again, part of the lessons learned, jumping the gun a little bit too quickly, investing a specific dollar amount, let's say, in a pathway that didn't materialize. And I'm not going to share that dollar amount because, you know, I don't want to start crying. But your question was, do you have any regrets? And I would tell you, I don't. It's part of lessons learned, mistakes made. I'm human. I make mistakes. Anyone tells you that they run a perfect shop is a liar. And there's no such thing. There's just no such thing as running a perfect business, no matter how much experience you have, no matter what you've gone through. And I've gone through a few businesses, but, you know, you're faced with something new every day. And as long as you're able to overcome and accelerate and go forward, ultimately, that's what your investors and, you know, your employees and your customers need you to do.
Well, you referenced your team there in that answer. How big is the team today? You know, kind of what's the makeup of the team? Engineers, you know, data scientists, you know, kind of what does the team look like today and with those around you?
Yeah, so it's still a small team. We're just under 10, like full time. Mm-hmm. You know, part time consultants, you know, gets us maybe a little bit closer to 20, but, you know, it's still a relatively small team. In terms of how we're made up, first of all, we're, you know, remote kind of first, like most companies today. Half of us are in Toronto, Canada. The other half are in Atlanta, Georgia. And it's all product and engineering. So it's all data scientists, product, and engineers. We do not have anybody in sales and marketing. We do use partners that we outsource, i.e. like how we got here today with you on the PR media side. We have a content marketing company who helps us as well, but we do not employ any full-time sales, BD, partnership, marketing people. It's all been product focused.
I see that you've raised, at least according to Crunchbase, you've raised some investor capital. I'm sure you've done this many times with many companies, but, you know, did you learn anything new this time around with Uplink in when raising capital, and you know, how was investor appetite and you know, interest in what you guys are building?
So just so you know, even though it's my fifth startup, this was the first time. And again, I know how young I look, but this is the first time that I have ever led the fundraising round. So previously, wow. I'd always been kind of like the support person. And even when I was CEO of another startup years and years ago, we didn't raise money at that time. So we were bootstrapping it. So this was really, it's always a learning experience, regardless whether it's your first time or your 20th time. It was really tough, really, really tough. you know, I don't think I'm going to tell you anything you haven't heard before, Todd. It sucked.
You never know.
It sucked.
Yeah.
Okay. Like, honestly, like, you know, I'm in sales and I'm used to getting no's. Like, my entire life, people have been telling me no because, you know, I'm in sales and I'm a sales guy. I'm not an engineer by trade. So I'm used to being told, no, go away. We hate your product. But I got to tell you, this thing, man, this thing was tough. A ton of rejections for different reasons. From, you know, your idea is not vetted enough to, your pre-revenue, pre-product market fit, to you don't have the right team in place, to, you know, usual stuff, you're too early. It was tough. And actually, I remember one of my early investors, we had raised the initial tranche, was telling me, don't raise for the second tranche. My gut told me, and it's on the larger size, my gut. It's on the larger size. My gut told me, don't listen to them. And thankfully I didn't. And we continued and we ended up raising some more. And here's the irony. We stopped fundraising over a year ago. And at that time we had raised just about, I'm just going to give you round numbers, 3.5. Since then, and then we took down the data room, I have not made one outbound investor call in a year. Since then, we've raised an additional 2.1. So since we haven't been raising and haven't needed the cash, and it's finally established ourselves, and I got to tell you, I get inundated with inbound requests for fundraising meetings. So I will tell you, it's the first 12 to 15 months were really, really tough. And like anything else, we found a few investors who took a shot. Most of them took a shot on me initially because my co-founder didn't join till after we had raised our first tranche. So for that, I'll ever be indebted to them. And I can only hope that we continue to excel as we have been to date and ultimately return their capital 10 times over. So
before we get to a final few lighter fun questions, you know, if a newly minted founder picked up the episode and there was starting this journey for the first time as someone who's had successes and failures, what would be something that you would tell them to give them a little wisdom?
So in general as a business or specifically to fundraising?
In general as a business, as you know, with your experience as being a founder with successful exits and as you mentioned at the top, a flop as well. What would you tell them as they embark on a founder journey themselves?
You know, what I would tell them is as you start this process, surround yourself at the advisory side with at least one or two individuals that you can really lean on. And, you know, I'll go to Uplink for a second. So here you have an experienced founder. And I had two individuals who were there almost as founding advisory board members. And I'll tell you the role they served. They were basically, and I'm not trying to discount it, just the opposite. I'm trying to embellish it. They were basically glorified cheerleaders. They really helped me, especially when I was trying to raise money off of a PowerPoint deck. Mm-hmm. It's like, nobody's going to give me money. Like, you know, you think when you can do it, Ron, you can do it. Here's your story. So they were great. I would, you know, advocate to any founder out there to surround yourself with individuals and whatever you want to call them, advisors, mentors who can help you, especially early on when the chances you know, the stakes are against you. That would be sort of one of the things I would state right at the get-go. Of course, there are other great pieces of advice, you know, great co-founders, do this, do that. If I would give that one piece of advice, that's what I would give.
With just a couple minutes that we have left here, some fun, lighter questions. Do you have a favorite book or the last book that you read?
Yeah, no, I have a book that I read pretty much every year. It's a little bit dated now, but I still think it's relevant. It's funny because when you read it, it's pre-financial crisis. So it's funny reading the names in it and the way the author talks about these names. And it's like, well, I know 2 years later, these guys were like terrible. So the book is Good to Great by Jim Collins. It's a highly inspirational book. I think it's one of the best business books ever written because it really talks more about leadership.
Yeah, I know exactly the book. Yeah, I've read it.
And like I read it every year and I always get something new out of it. And, you know, for me, it's a book about how to be a good leader.
Yeah.
And that's something that I'm trying to work on every day because I don't think I'm anywhere near where I want to be in terms of being a good leader. I think I have a lot to improve on, a lot to work on, and I want to do that. And it's a very inspirational book when I read it. And again, it's funny because, Fannie Mae did this. So Fannie Mae like went bankrupt 2 years later. But so if you kind of put that aside,
yeah, exactly.
And read it and understand what the core message is, it's fantastic. It literally, it gets me, it actually inspires me. So,
yep, I would agree. You know, all founders need to step away. They need to keep their heads clear, especially for you know, their teams and those around them. So what do you do to unwind and kind of take your mind off the job for a little bit and keep yourself refreshed?
You know, here's the thing. I can give you a bullshit answer or I can tell you straight up. I don't do a good job at that. So I don't know. I don't know. I'd much rather
have the honest answer.
I don't know. And I'll tell you, like, it's been one of the struggles I've had in my career. It almost cost me my marriage a long time ago. I don't know how to turn it off. I work 7 days a week. And it's not that I'm trying to embark these principles on anybody else. And I'm not saying this is the right thing to do. In fact, I wish I could be different, to be honest with you. But I don't have a good answer for that because I have not been successful in finding a way to do that. But never say never, right? Right? Mm-hmm. Never say never.
That's right.
Like, I'm still a young man. I can still figure it out, and hopefully I'll figure it out this last time around.
Do you have a favorite sport or sports teams that you root for? I'm going to guess in Canada that you're a big hockey fan, but maybe I'm wrong.
I am in Canada, but I'm not a big hockey fan. favorite sport to play is baseball. Favorite sport to watch and, you know, exciting is it's football, American football. So,
do you have
do you have and I also love college. I also love college athletics. Like, I love U.S. college football. I love U.S. college basketball. Big congrats out to the UConn Huskies, 5-0 in national championship games. I was there for your first one in 99 when you beat Duke. Hey, Duke.
Rip Hamilton and Jim Calhoun.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. You don't look that old. Like, yeah, that's right.
Rip Hamilton. I remember.
Yeah. That was a great game. So, yeah, I do love watching sports. And so, I actually love, you know, one of my favorite sports things to watch is actually, you're going to laugh, the NFL draft. I love watching the NFL. And my wife was like, how can you sit there And you're like some guy goes up to a podium every 15 minutes, reads one name and then goes away. And then you have to wait 15 minutes again. And you got a bunch of guys in suits like because that's boring. At least if you're watching a game.
There's a hopefulness to it. Like, you know, this could be the next guy.
I get so excited about the draft. It's crazy. I love the NFL.
I watch it every year as much as I can. Do you have a favorite vacation spot?
I do not. I have a bucket list of where I'd like to go, but I don't have a favorite vacation spot.
So final question, you know, what inspires you? What keeps you going? You know, you've done this many, many times. Obviously you have the family history of entrepreneurship, but is there anything else that keeps you inspired and keeps you going?
No, I would tell you that I've always been someone who's been self-motivated and, you know, never needed others to really, you know, needed the success of others to push me. But, you know, in this case, especially for Uplink, there is such a purpose and sort of a mission. And, you know, my co-founder and I have talked about, wouldn't it be great if in like, I don't know, 3 years, 5 years, whatever, we could sit down and put just a simple calculation together and say, you know what, Uplink in the last 5 years has helped lenders extend, I don't know, whatever, a number, $100 billion to small business. Like, to me, when I thought about that, like, that made me happy. Like, made me happy because, you know, I remember when the pandemic started and I just walked out my front door, my condo, and I saw immediately a couple of stores in my local community were boarded up. I remember how I felt. I had tears. So for me, you know, as far as Uplink goes, that's sort of what the day-to-day motivator is.
Well, Ron, I greatly appreciate you giving me some time today. If someone wanted to reach out to you or the team, how can they do that? How can they reach out to you?
You know, on our website, we have our, you know, contact at uplink.co, but I am a LinkedIn troll. I am on LinkedIn, you know, 98,000 times a day. So I'm easy. And I'm, by the way, the only Ron Benegbi in the world. So if you punch in Ron Benegbi into LinkedIn, you know how you get a certain, like there's, that's it. One thing comes, that's me. So you're not going to have trouble finding me. It's not like I'm John Smith. So, you know, LinkedIn is good too.
Well, I appreciate it again. Continued success to you and the team. Hopefully we'll get you back sometime in the future.
Appreciate it. Thanks so much, Todd. Take care.
Yep. Thank you.